Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello, welcome to Coming Cast with me, Tony Robinson, and today it's going to be a bit wibbly-wobbly because we are doing the history of jelly. Stop sniggering in the back row, this is a very serious podcast. Jelly, like everything else, has a very serious history. I want to rescue jelly from its place as a children's party food because there was a time when making jellies was an art form and took pride of place on the tables of the wealthy. And my two excellent guests today are going to help me out in describing all this. The leading food historian and presenter Annie Gray and the remarkable Mr. Willy Wonka himself, the entrepreneur Sam Bompas.
So there was a thing in America for a jello salad. There was a vogue for setting all the elements of a salad, sometimes cooked elements, into sweet jellies. And into that you would set grapes, lettuce, walnuts, olives. You might mix it with a bit of mayonnaise as well, maybe some cooked potato, and you sort of build this thing up, and every single element adds a new level of just absolute horror to the entire thing.
But it does look spectacular.
It looks amazing.
It looks incredible. If you're putting together a sideboard, maybe there's a space for it.
But before we go to that, here's Melissa, my producer. She's here again for a chat, aren't you, mate?
Jelly Tony? Why?
Jelly Tony. You can't just say Jelly Tony. That's not a question.
I'm not calling you Jelly Tony.
All right.
So I'm just saying Jelly, Tony, question mark?
Yeah, I've always loved jelly. I think every kid of my generation loved jelly. It was just kind of magic, wasn't it? You open the packet and there were these squares inside and they were just jam-packed full of flavour, and then you would put them in the water and stir and stir and put them. We didn't have a fridge in the very early days of my life. You'd put them outside. And when they came back in, they would be a jelly. What could be more wonderful than that?
Do you have a very early jelly memory, or is it just general jelly memories? Jelly heaven?
Oh, yeah, just jelly heaven. Well, jelly's different from everything else. That's the odd thing about it. I mean, maybe that's the reason more than any other why I wanted to do it as a podcast. I can't think of any other food that wobbles in the way that jelly does.
It was quite a challenge, Tony, when you said, let's make a podcast about jelly. And I was thinking, okay, can we do jelly? But actually, I think we can, because we've got two really interesting guests to talk about.
Yeah, well, everything has a context, doesn't it? I mean, to be quite honest, that's what I'm saying, isn't it? In all of these podcasts, whether it's about, I don't know, something like facial hair or tattoos, they all have a context. And of course, jelly does too.
Cool, let's get to it. Let's hear about the history of jelly.
Bring it on, jelly, baby. Today I'm with Sam Bompas, who is a food entrepreneur, a food specialist, and a jelly specialist, and Annie Gray, who is a food historian. And what we're talking about is jellies and all things wobbly. Sam, what's your favourite flavour of jelly?
Well, the thing I love about jelly is if anyone makes you a jelly, you can almost immediately tell what their palate is like. Making a jelly is a bit like making a cocktail. So I'd often advocate, if you're making a jelly for yourself, choose a favourite cocktail. For myself, I love Negronis. Negroni jelly can be really, really exquisite, but also alarmingly strong. If you're making it like a Negroni, it will be as strong as a Negroni. So brace yourself and be careful.
And make sure it's a little jelly.
Well, or make sure you don't have any responsibilities afterwards.
Annie, favourite jelly?
I like a champagne jelly. It doesn't have to be champagne. Could be any other sparkling wine. But if you chill the bottle really, really well before you make it, then you retain the bubbles in it. So when you eat it, you do get a proper fizz on your tongue. And it's even better if you set bits of fruit in it, because then you sort of feel like you're healthy as well as slightly drunk at the end of it.
Is it just a coincidence that both of you have chosen alcohol-based jellies?
I would have thought so, probably. But I don't know, there's something... I suspect it's something to do with the fact that we both study jelly and we're both really into jelly, and therefore we see jelly as something that is adult and interesting and sophisticated, not just kind of blackcurrant cubes that you add water to.
Although blackcurrant cubes you add water to shouldn't be knocked, I have to say.
True,
they brought me into the world of jelly.
It's fair, it's fair. But they are kind of better, I think, when you eat them as cubes rather than when you actually add the water to them.
It's funny, though, that when I asked you that question, the way your faces went when you told me about the flavour of jelly you liked was very young and a little bit naughty, which is sort of what jelly's like, isn't it? It's, ooh, jelly, it's a different thing. It's not like penguin biscuits or yo-yos or hard-boiled eggs. It's from a different world.
Yes, I slap a jelly on the table, everyone smiles, everyone's got a jelly story. You know, given that jelly is now something that you arrive at very, very early on, you have lots of memories to access, but I think jelly can also be done in a very sophisticated way, and that's perhaps where the booze is coming in.
Yeah, and let's face it, there is nothing else like jelly. There is nothing that wobbles on the table. There's nothing that's slightly smutty, but also just delightful in the way that jelly is. And there's nothing that feels like jelly in the mouth. Even the word is kind of slightly sort of seaside humoury combined with magical delight. So I just don't think there's anything else like it.
No, it must be one of the most tactile foods. I'm sure that somebody wrote a book called Jelly in My Knickers. If they haven't, they should, because that combination of jelly and your bum, I just think is...
Well, it does take you to a whole world of niche interest. If you're interested in looking at it, there's a whole subgenre in the internet called sploshing, which involves, amongst other things, sitting in jelly.
Really? Is that true?
It's very easy for you to substantiate with the internet.
When you say among other things, can you tell us what any of the other things are?
Oh, well, like in the world of slimy foods and food you might like to sit on, there's cakes, there's baked beans. I think particular people have particular interests. We came upon it very early in our first forays as jelly mongers when we set out 16 years ago to really explore the world of jelly making, and we didn't really have very many commissions. One of the first was to make jelly for a splosh party, which I think in our then prudishness we declined, but maybe
you wouldn't,
maybe I, who knows.
Tell us about your company, because it's an extraordinary story.
16 years ago or so, set up Bombs and Parr with my business partner, Harry Parr, and very long time friend. We've known each other since we've been 13. And we want to make fine jellies, like the historic ones. We want to use beautiful copper molds. I've actually got one here that we made. And we found that we couldn't afford them. They're really fancy. If you buy an antique one, they cost a lot of money. So it might be sort of 400 quid or so. And that's when Harry realized he could use the same things he'd learned trained to be an architect, same techniques, same technology, and instead of using it to design buildings, he'd use it to design jellies.
That is one of the days of inhuman history, isn't it?
It's nice as well, though, isn't it? Because Carême infamously said that cookery was the finest branch of all the arts, and that architecture was sort of the bit that cookery sat in. So it's sort of fitting, and it does fit with what you do in terms of the history of jellies and the kind of bringing of history to the present and the making of it being relevant and those kind of things.
Well, Carême is one of our absolute culinary heroes. If you look at his, they call him Pismonté.
Who is he?
So he's known as the King of Chefs and Chef de Kings. He cooked variously for George IV, the Tsar Nicholas I, and spent his off hours in the library looking at architecture and then drawing it as cake. Or then walking around St. Petersburg and thinking about improvements that he, with his chef's eye, could make to the palaces that were then being built.
Annie, one of the phrases that you used just now was the history of jelly. I know everything has got a history. What do we know about its early days?
Well, it developed quite slowly. So jelly comes from, or jelly, gelatin, the basic substance to make jelly, is the collagen that holds bones, sinews, all those things together. So if you boil down any animal or any fish, you will get some form of jelly coming out of that. And the earliest references to jelly really come from the 14th century, but quite clearly anybody who's ever boiled anything will have some form of jelly. But sometime around the medieval period, the early medieval period, people started to realise that this was quite an interesting substance. It looked nice. You could potentially strain that jelly and make it look even nicer, because then it would look clearer. And you could use that in a culinary sense to then set meats into. So the earliest jellies, and certainly the earliest recipes for jellies, turn out to be things much more like brawn. So a meat that's been, you normally take trotters, pig's head is normally modern brawn. Those things are boiled down, boiled and boiled and boiled and boiled, and then eventually you get the meat, which is now so tender you could just sort of pass a spoon through it, and then the jelly that's come off it, and you would set that meat in the jelly. And today a brawn would often be turned out. They don't seem to have been turned out in the early medieval period, or indeed really until the 17th century. But there was nevertheless a big development within jellies as people got more confident with making them. People also started to use a substance called isinglass, which is the gallbladder of a sturgeon, believe it or not. The best ones came from Russia. And isinglass was used to set jellies on fast days. So if you adhered to Catholicism, as of course we did in Britain until the Reformation, then about half the year was a fast day. You couldn't eat any animal products. So then you'd use your isinglass. And we had our meat jellies, we had our fish-based jellies. And then in the 17th century, there seems to be this coming together of technology and of thought and of interest in food. It's a huge time of culinary change. And that's the point where you start to get the first jellies, which are called crystal jellies, and where you get the development of what will be, for the next 200 years or so, the jelly-making substance par excellence, which is calf's foot jelly.
So we've now come to the great burgeoning of jelly ideas. But scrolling back a bit, you'd say that the earliest jellies weren't turned out. So presumably they were carried around, just like you'd carry around a pasty or a cake or whatever, the transporting of food, you think?
They were much, much softer, we think, than the jellies that you'd get now. So you wouldn't be able to sort of boing a fork off them. More like the meat you'd get on a pork pie, although they could be quite stiff as well. So if you think about, for example, a beautiful silver or pewter bowl with some fish in that, cooked fish in that, and those fish are set into jelly. So you could carry them around, but they weren't designed for transportation. These were things that would be cooked up and put on the table. By its very nature, jelly involves meat, so it's going to only be served to people who are wealthy. It also is very time consuming to make. So again, this denotes wealth. So these are the kind of dishes that you would get on the table of the aristocracy, of princes, of kings, of queens. These are dishes that are designed to look beautiful, to sparkle, to please the palate as much as please the eye.
But going back to this notion of the pie and the jelly on top of it, does that have any significance? I love the jelly on a pork pie, but is it just a gloss?
No, I mean, Sam's cooked a lot of pies, so you know as well as I do that pouring the jelly in, it helps to not only preserve the meat inside, but it also helps with the integrity of the pie. I mean, you've made some really big examples of pies, I suspect, so you'll know that the jelly's sometimes crucial.
Yeah, but it's useful as a preservative, yeah. And also to, if you're cutting it around, to keep it looking good, but especially at a time before refrigeration, having gels around like that is really rather wonderful. Of course, it can be a lot of effort. Have you tried to make medieval style jellies, Annie?
I've made calf's foot jelly, and yeah, it was 3 days that I'm never going to get back. Oh, worth doing. The flavour was unbelievable, and the wobble,
I think,
was
worth doing once.
Yes, once. And then you realise that packet gelatin is one of the few cook shortcuts that is definitely worth having.
I quite like the Talavant jelly recipe, which says, and it's part of the recipe instructions.
Sorry, the what?
So Taliban, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. I've only read it, but you know, one of the very early 12th century cooks.
Yeah.
The recipe says, if you make a jelly, you do not need to sleep.
Because
there's so much work.
Oh, it's really
it just takes, like, if you're making it from scratch without the sort of leaf gelatin that we now use, you need to spend a lot of time clarifying.
They're in big quantities, a lot of the early recipes as well. So a gang of calves' feet is quite common in the 18th century, which is 4 calves' feet. Big, big calf's feet. Veal was slaughtered slightly later then. So you need big vessels, huge amounts of calf's feet, loads, gallons of water, loads of spice as well in these early jellies. And then once you'd boiled and boiled and boiled to extract all the gelatin, then it would be strained 3, 4, 5 times. Oh, and between times you'd have to let it sit to skim the fat off as well. So this really was a process that would literally take days before you even just had the jelly. And then that had to be flavoured up with wine and also sometimes with sack, which is a type of fortified wine, so a lot like sherry, until you ended up with something that was kind of, I suppose, what would you describe the taste as? It's kind of vaguely meaty, but only just.
Yeah, you're still haunted by the meat, and it's still in the same way that if you get low grade gelatin or bronze grade gelatin, it's always a little bit porcine.
I was going to say that's piggy though, whereas if you use the calf's feet, it's more sort of vealy. Mm. So it's a slightly, yeah, and the mouthfeel is slightly different as well. It's a bit more, just a bit more gelatinous, I suppose, is the right way to describe it. A bit more like eating a really softly boiled tendon.
I know that vegetarians still really steer clear of gelatin. What kind of process is it, the sort of mass manufacture of it?
Well, I don't know if they do totally steer clear of it. And we've had a lot of experience with that, making literally tens of thousands of jellies over the year. And sometimes you feel, I don't know if it's the playfulness of the jelly or it's reverting back to childhood. Sometimes quite strict adherents of a vegetarian or even a vegan diet will give themselves permission to have a jelly. That said, the making of the gelatin is using a lot of the most horrific bits of at the moment Britain pig, and you're putting the pig skin through sort of successive layers of acid bath to wash out all the collagen rich elements of it. But the good thing is you're using all of the animal that is being slaughtered primarily for the meat is being separated and put to good use.
So. Yeah, it's proper nose-to-tail eating. Mm. I think it's something that people don't tend to think about when they have a jelly, that this is actually incredibly, in some ways, ethical.
But there are some really, really good gelling agents as well. They're not quite as good. They don't have the same mouthfeel. And the good thing about gelatin is it melts at body temperature. So it just feels luxurious and silken as you put it in your mouth. But
and
you can,
if you muck it up, you can also reboil it and reset it. It's very, very massively important in the past, where you could reuse your jellies, melt them down, set them into smaller shapes, stripe them up so that you would never really have any form of waste from your jelly.
It's so forgiving. But you can use agar agar and recommend that.
Is that a vegetarian option?
Yeah.
It's seaweed, isn't it?
It's made out of seaweed, yeah.
And does it work as well as gelatin?
It works differently. So you don't get the same mouthfeel. The good thing is that you can get some quite, you know, so in different countries, you know, jelly is not a uniquely British story. We have our own cultural food ways with it. But if you're, you know, hot countries make jellies as well. So there are beautiful jellies made across Southeast Asia using agar agar. And because it's a little bit more brittle, you can use different tools, or gelatine as in Mexico. Because it's a little bit more brittle, you can use tools to inscribe names and flowers and sort of quite ornate, you know, designs within the fissures you can sort of sculpt into the jelly in a way that you can't really do it with gelatin.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hi, this is Tony Robinson bringing you my Cunning Cast. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave a rating or a review. And do take a look at our back catalogue. There's a growing selection of shows there to keep you company. Everything from Census, Coronation, Knights, What the Past Smelt Like, loads and loads. You're going to find something you like, aren't you? Annie's brought us up to 17th
18th century with the history of jelly. Before we explore that, give us part two of the story of your business, because now you're making really exotic jellies, aren't you?
Well, at that point, we knew how to make jellies with malts. I've brought some along, actually. So what we found out is, through using sort of CAD design, we could then 3D print a mold. Here's St. Paul's Cathedral. It's one of the very first ones that we designed. And actually, a few years ago, I asked Harry what his best design jelly was, and he said St. Paul's Cathedral. And I said, maybe some other designers and architects had, Christopher Wren had something to do with it. But once you've got this, this is really the tool. And then we'd use a vac former. So as you might have had at school in your design classes, your crafting classes, to punch that through and stretch some plastic over it. And that'll give you a plastic mold like this. And these plastic molds kind of work. Of all the molds, you know, very, very, very thin plastic molds that we make will get the best heat transfer through it. If you have the mass manufactured plastic molds, they're horrid to use. If you have ceramic molds, forget about it. Oh. They're almost impossible to use.
Glass
you have
is
to,
even worse.
And glass even worse. With those, it took me a long time to get to grips with them. And eventually I ended up calling up Ivan Day. He's like the sort of Indiana Jones of the pantry. guess like yourself, Annie. And he said that where we'd gone wrong was not lining the molds with animal fats to be able to vigorously shake out the jellies.
You saying that, I have a really vivid memory when I must have been about 5 or 6. We had glass molds in our house, and the problem always was getting those little bits at the top out. They would just stay there, gripping to the glass.
They're an absolutely awful design. The glass molds that you get almost everywhere in antique shops and sort of junk shops, the sort of characteristic glass ones that have almost like a bunch of grapes in the top, they're not, they're just geometric forms. But the secret is Trex or other. You can use lard, but it tends to leave a certain taint. Or you can solidify something like almond oil. If you put that in the fridge or the freezer, that will turn solid. And if you're really, really quick, you can brush it on. But Trex or other vegetable shortening is much, much better. Even then, to be honest, I've had disasters where the entire top half just stays in the mould because, of course, it just forms this suction cup.
I'm sorry, I love that you use the term jelly disaster. It's something it's something that's haunted us for over a decade, and there's always an impending fridge failure.
Every time, because you transport them and you think this is going to be fine, but you never, ever know until you turn it out whether something's got stuck or whether there's a sort of random hole in the mould. If you're using copper ones, you sometimes don't spot the fact there's a hole. I mean, just all sorts of things. Ones where there are some of the ceramic molds that you get were designed to have a flummery, which is white jelly, basically what we'd call blancmange, put in, and you could colour that. So you could say you've got a mold with a lion on top or something. You could do the lion in white and then the rest in a red jelly. But to do that, obviously, you need to set the lion or partially set that, then pour in the second colour. And it's very, very easy to overset the first bit so that when you turn it out, the lion just neatly slides off the entire thing onto the plate, winks at you for a couple of seconds, and then slides onto your feet.
You very quickly referred to blancmange, which to me was certainly on a par with jelly, although it was often sniffed at in certain quarters. How did blancmange come about?
Well, blancmange started as a medieval recipe based on chicken and rice, and it sort of gradually morphed into something that was more usually set with another gelling agent, really, than gelatin. So by the 20th century, it had become set with rice flour a lot of the time, or corn flour, kind of coming full circle. But in the kind of intervening 500 years, it went through this phase of being rice-based, not rice-based, cream-based, milk-based, and settled into a white jelly. And there was also jaunmange, which translates as yellow eat, in the way that blancmange translates as white eat. And jaunmange was a blancmange coloured yellow, sometimes by using lots and lots of egg yolks, sometimes by faking it with sandalwood or something like that. So blancmange really now, and for about 150 years, has just meant a gelled white jelly-like substance, but not always based on gelatin. It was very much associated with the working class by the 1870s, 1880s, and often moulded to the point that things that were like blancmange often got called just shape. So by the 20th century, you get a lot of people that just serve. So this is kind of lower middle class and below. People just put shape on their menus, or they just go out and say, we're going to have shape for tea. And they're usually set by then with cornflour, so just milk, cornflour, sugar, and that's pretty much it. And sometimes you might get a little bit of flavouring in there if you're lucky, but they're quite basic. I find blancmange delicious. I love the purity of something that's just really good milk or really good cream and not much else, but it did become a bit of a joke.
The skin on the bottom of a blancmange.
Oh, precisely. Oh.
Sam, do you use blancmange?
Yeah, of course. I think Annie was talking about layer jellies.
Yeah.
A really beautiful layer jelly you can make is layers of blancmange and then like a strawberry jelly as well. And you get this incredible vivid red and white stripe all the way down. And it's the contrast is remarkable. Of course, every layer takes a little bit of time to set. So yeah, be careful when you're setting it. I think one of the chefs in our studio made for my father's 75th birthday a jelly with 75 layers. And that's about an hour to set in each one. So that was incredibly kind.
You just kind of glossed over a phrase which epitomised wonderfulness for me when I was a kid, which was jelly and blancmange. The two together produce a really nice taste, don't they?
Yeah, well, it's almost like self-sourcing with your cream. You've got to inset within the dish. And one of the things with jellies is sometimes there is a risk of having a sort of blandness of uniformity of dish. And the things that we love when we're eating is contrast. So contrast of colour, which we're getting with those two colours, but also contrast of texture. So setting something within the jelly, be it bubbles or fruit, or having something on the side of it as well, can really help maintain the interest across the dish.
Yeah, we've got a really long tradition of jelly and ice cream. I lived in France for a while, and the host family with whom I stayed, Madame, was aghast at the idea of jelly and ice cream. She thought this was pretty much the worst excess of British cuisine. And I mean, in it, obviously,
Sam's looking totally
on.
Shocked. Is that horror at her ignorance?
No, it's familiarity. It's, not having much luck getting commissions. We had commissions all over the world, but never
for France. They really don't do jellies apart from the savoury aspects. But I mean, there are references to eating jelly with cream in the 17th century, and jelly was often served on the table at the same time as ice cream because it was part of the dessert course. And dessert for really anybody in the 17th century onwards, up until kind of the mid 20th century, dessert was not what we would call dessert today, which is kind of brownies and cakes and quite heavy things. Desserts was intended to be a palate cleanser. So you'd have your soups and your fish and your meats and your roasts and your vegetables and your tarts and your pies and your puddings. And then when you were sort of gasping for breath at the end of the meal, in would come dessert, and it would be jellies, it would be ice creams, it would be nuts, and it would be perfect hothouse fruit. So the idea was that you just sort of ate something that would leave you fizzing, really, as you then went off somewhat drunk into the night. So this association of jelly and ice cream is a really old one. And confectioners, when they started to sell jellies, so you wouldn't have to make them in-house, you could go out and buy your jellies and buy your ice creams, they often listed those together. And then they sort of went on as this kind of, you just always had jelly and ice cream. They went hand in hand until by the 20th century, jelly and ice cream was what you served at parties. And then inevitably they became associated with children. So I think, you know, it's not this kind of plebeian, why would you do that thing that Madame thought it was. It's actually a really, really good combination with really strong historical roots.
And the ices, one of the things, so we're very familiar with jellies being moulded now, and happily many jellies still are moulded now, but we've rather forgotten the tradition of moulded ices.
Yes.
And I've got on my desk at work, I've got a potato ice cream mould.
Oh, they're brilliant. Have you used it?
It's so good. It's so fun to use, and it just fills me with sort of wonder. And like the idea that, well, of course, with a lot of these historic dishes, you get some really wild recipes and potato-based ices.
Can you explain your potato ice cream mould?
Well, it's like a little tuber, and it's two halves of pewter that are hinged. And as you're making your ice cream in the ice cream maker, you'll scoop out a load of it, and you'll shape it into this mould, and then you push it together and scrape off the excess, then re-refrigerate this so that it takes on solidity and it can maintain its shape out on the table. Ready for service. And then you'll pass a sort of delicate cloth over it to unmold it, or run it over under some tepid water, and out pops a little potato ice cream.
Do you do many shaped ice creams for your business, or do they melt too quickly for that to be practical?
Not particularly. I'm in love with them. I think they're miraculous. They are very, very hard work. So again, with this, when we're looking at the sort of glory days of jelly and ice cream, when it was at its real zenith, you're looking at effectively elite food, where masses of man hours and great resources, including the jelly molds themselves and the ice cream molds themselves, which are not a useful cooking implement implement, a useful cooking implement, is a pot or a knife or a board that you can use for almost anything. A jenny mould or an ice cream mould is... You're not cooking for necessity anymore, you're cooking for show.
I mean, it is worth saying that people, I think, have a tendency to go to English Heritage Houses, National Trust Houses, Brighton Pavilion, and they see all the moulds, and they instinctively go, oh, look at the jelly moulds. Didn't people love jelly? And it is worth pointing out, I think, that so many more things were moulded in the past than now. Not just ice cream, but cakes. An awful lot of the moulds that people see, especially if they've got a flat bottom, were for cakes. So there was a particular type of cake called a Savoy cake. So it's sort of a light sponge that was always moulded. You would mould suet puddings, you'd mould Christmas puddings. I mean, if it could be moulded, if it would hold a shape, you would do it. Rice would be put in a border mould. Marmalades would be set in moulds. I mean, you know, absolutely everything was moulded. So if you think about jelly in isolation, you're doing it a disservice. You need to think of a table full of moulded items. And again, as Sam says, it's all very much elite food at that point in the 18th century.
I've been holding off the 18th century until now, but let's give it its head. What happened that transformed jelly at that time?
People realised they could mould jelly. They could make it stiff enough to mould and hold a shape. And the first time you sort of get this happening seems to be around the 1660s, 1670s. There's a cook called Robert May who talks about moulding jellies into scallop shells, so clearly using actual scallop shells, but he also talks about wooden and tin moulds. Now, he was writing, really looking back at the food before the English Revolution, so he was looking back at the food of the 1630s and 1640s. So by then, we know things were being moulded and turned out. And from then on, really, it's quite a quick change to jellies being habitually moulded. Not all of them. You still get lots and lots of jellies served in glasses. So there are jelly glasses, very popular way to serve jelly, certainly at the beginning of the 18th century, so sort of 1710, 1720s, was to have a series of really beautiful, very, very delicate little glasses with handles on. And they would be served on salvers, often tiered salvers, a bit like the cake stands you'd get in hotels today. And you'd have different coloured jellies a lot of the time. So by this point, people were really experimenting with using food colourings in jelly. So you might have a yellow jelly, a green jelly, a white jelly, and a red jelly, blancmange, all of them displayed on this beautiful silver salver and then stacking up to the ceiling. But you also started to get moulded jellies, first of all in fairly simple shapes, and then increasingly in weirder and wilder and more just brilliant, brilliant shapes. So if you were to look at, for example, Elizabeth Raffles' cookbook published in 1769, Experienced English Housekeeper, one of the absolute best books of the 18th century, she has a whole section on jellies. And as you read it, your jaw is just dropping. Everything from the moon and stars in jelly to a transparent pudding, which is absolutely one of the best jellies I've ever had, and completely fits the textural, Sam's nodding, completely fits this idea of having texture in it, because it's basically a pudding, so Christmas pudding style, so it's got currants, it's got nuts in, it's got candied peel in, but without the flour and the eggs. So what you've got is jelly, but then you look through and you've got all of this fruit suspended in the jelly. So you have textural contrast, taste contrast. Her jellies were magnificent.
And what's the moon and the stars one? How did that operate?
So there's a vogue for having things set in jelly, really making use of the magnifying properties of a clear jelly. So with moon and stars in jelly, and there were other things too, cornucopias of fruit and jelly and melons and things like that.
Oh, I like an undersea adventure. it's wonderful.
Yes. Is that true? An undersea adventure.
They're so good. You'd get a bowl and you'd fill that with your beautiful clear jelly. And into that, as it's set, you would set little moulds with the design on the outside. So they would be set into the jelly. And then when that jelly had fully set, you would take out the little moulds, leaving, of course, little crevices where they were, with often very intricate designs on them. And then you would pour in very, very gently some white blancmange. Or perhaps you'd insert some gilded fish, because, you know, just making jelly isn't hard enough. Let's add some gilding as well. And when you then set that and then turned all of that out, you've got, as you're looking through it, you've got exactly that, an undersea adventure. And of course, this is an age where refrigeration didn't exist. To set these jellies, you had to obtain ice from your ice house. So even just setting the jellies is an extra layer of just unbelievable hassle.
And we think about, there's jeopardy in making jellies with a reliable refrigerator. refrigerator. Yes. But imagine doing that with all of the ice and then presenting that on the table where it's quivering away, the whole sort of thing acting as sort of optic lens, big old wobbles. It's a total moment spectacle.
I will be fair, I actually prefer setting jellies using a bucket of ice than I do using a fridge, because if you set your jelly in a bucket of ice, so basically you get a huge bucket, fill it full of crushed ice and put a tea cloth in it just so the ice doesn't leap out and into your jelly, set your mould into that, you can make those layered jellies without having to move the jelly mould. And it's that I always find the moment of total jeopardy when it splashes up the side. So it's an early 19th century method of making them, although it's probably much earlier. It's just mentioned at that point for the first time. I find that a much surer way to do it. And I've had to do it in costume in front of the public using that method and using natural food colouring. So that does, it raises the level of jeopardy to kind of warning lights going off.
You're listening to Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson, and my very special guests are talking jelly this week, Annie Gray and Sam Bompas. Sam, the kind of complexity of jellies that Annie's been talking about, in a way, you're doing a second renaissance, aren't you, with your company? You're creating the wonders of jelly that certainly my post-war generation has never come across before.
Well, I think jelly's just a terrific medium for creativity. And I think as soon as you start exploring what can be done with it, I've been making jellies for 16 years. I still order every jelly there is to be had on any menu, and keep on thinking of new ideas to do with jellies as well. It's relentless. And so what you saw with all of that history of mold making was every new form of craftsmanship, every new technology soon found its way into the domain of jelly. So electroforming comes along, you get more complicated jellies and with ever more intricate shapes. And that's in the 19th century, of course. Today, with sort of video technologies, we can have jellies that respond to you as you're eating them, that have a face with an expression that will react as you carve into the nose or ear or eye with a spoon and shriek in horror. We've made holograms in jellies as well, which had a spinning crucified Jesus for a biblical Easter jelly, which is an innovation at the time. I thought it'd be more shocking than it was. Actually, it seemed delightful. But there's still things that we're discovering to do with jelly. And I think as new technologies become available, then we'll find more things to do.
You've also created very large jellies, haven't you?
Yeah, well, it's a thing that we always got asked to do for many, many years, create vast jellies. And of course, some of our first jellying was making architectural jellies, which is jellies in the shape of architecture, but not on an architectural scale. We've talked a little bit about mouthfeel and how much you need to set a jelly for it to come out of a mold or be set in a jelly glass. And of course, if you're setting it in a vessel, then you use much less of the gelling agent than if you're setting it in a mold and it has to last out. The challenge with that is the more gelling agent you put in, the less it wobbles, and wobbling's always great with the jelly, but also the more delayed the release of flavors you get. And sometimes, when you have a jelly that's just on the verge of being liquescent, that's when you get the very best mouthfeel. So scaling it up, so what you find is actually when you're making jellies in molds, the molds don't tend to be that big. They tend to be a litre, maybe pushing it a litre and a half. If you think about it, that's not that big on the table. It's not that impressive. But we finally worked out how to make really, really big jellies. That was using totally different gelling agents. We managed to make a 50-ton jelly was the pinnacle. And again, not a lot of sleep involved. Set round Isambard King of Brunel's ship, the SS Great Britain. It was pretty wild to do.
What kind of events do you do them for? What was the SS Great Britain one down in Bristol?
That was in Bristol, and that was for a show called Museums at Night and put together by Culture 24. And the idea was to get people into museums across Britain who the stuff that museums normally do doesn't really appeal to them. And in quite a weird setup, artists had their names thrown in a ring, and the museums could bid for artists, but the museums would tell the artists what to do. Now, most of the artists sensibly said, well, we'll come and do a talk. And said, no one to. And we said, this sounds great. We'll do anything. And I think the most anyone else had was four bids. We had 50 bids for us because we said we'd do anything. And it was quite extraordinary things. Some of them were just from a very small museum in the Outer Hebrides. And they said, yeah, we're just going to have a bonfire. We've got great whiskey. Don't really care what happens, but it'll be a lot of fun. So that sounded a lot of fun. And the SS Great Britain in Bristol said, come float our boat on a sea of jelly. And we said, that sounds marvellous. We'll be up for it. And then the public voted for what they wanted to happen. And this is the early days of Twitter. They got the vote out and they were eventual winners. We sat down, discovered the budget. It was £500. Which, to make 50 tons of jelly is not a lot, but it was such a good idea. I love it when there's a good idea that you can get really excited about. And
how did you make it?
Well, we had in our lockup, through a mishap, we'd at one point commissioned all of the sodium alginate in the world at the time to be made for a series of chocolate waterfalls. But there was alginate left over. We said, if you...
Just a note to the listener, you are awake. Carry on.
We said, we will supply and we will give you all the sodium alginate that we need to make this jelly. It wasn't edible, I should say, because we didn't want to waste the food, we just use the sodium alginate. But we'll need two things, waste disposal and a lot of help. And they said, no problem. And they fixed that up. And as the only event I've had sponsored by a waste disposal company that came to clean up all the jelly and make sure it was properly disposed of. And then the helpers that day were the community's payback team. So we had a actually brilliant and incredibly motivated group of people who are doing community service. And their community service happened to be making an awful lot of jelly for Bristol folk. It was great fun.
Let's go back to the time span of jellies. So we've now talked about the 18th century. What was happening at the time of the Industrial Revolution and beyond?
Well, one of the big stories was, as Sam has mentioned, mould technology changing. So you get tin moulds coming in, which means that the middle classes can start to make their own jellies. But actually, most of the time, the middle class are not making their own jellies, because to obtain the ice, to get hold of the ingredients, to get the moulds, to find the staff, to have the right amount of skill in the kitchen, it was just forget it. So jellies started being made a lot more by professionals, by confectioners. So you would order in your dessert course, really. And one of the big breakthroughs in terms of making that much more possible was the invention of packet gelatin, so ready-made gelatin, which would come in little packets. It was usually a powder, and later on you'd get leaf gelatin. The first patent for that was 1847, although that patent actually talks about a new process for making gelatin, so almost certainly you could have obtained ready-made gelatin before. The problem was it wasn't very good. Mrs. Beaton mentioned the fact that it was often quite badly flavoured, and although she may or may not have had actual experience of that, given that she plagiarised pretty much all of her recipes, she did normally draw upon lots of sources, so what she says is usually fairly accurate. So the gelatin that was available wasn't great, and most cooks who were worth their salt, and certainly all professional chefs, carried on boiling down calves' feet to make into jellies really until the end of that century. But of course, once you start to get jellies becoming slightly more cheap and slightly more in the reach of the masses, what happens is that those people that really can afford it start to want to make even more incredible jellies. So by the end of the century, the range of jelly moulds you could get was absolutely extraordinary. And I mean, you get things like the Alexandra cross and the Danish cross. And these are what are known as pillar moulds. So they're very, very tall moulds, really almost impossible to use. And they are in the shape of, in one case, it's the Danish flag. In another case, I mean, all sorts of symbols. And what you do is you pour jelly into them, and then you set a sort of liner into them that hangs on top. And then you take the liner out when the first jelly is done, almost like making the moon and stars, but sort of, what's that, sort of 30 centimetres tall, something like that. Then you pour in another jelly, and sometimes several different colours of jelly, until when you turn it out, every time you slice across it horizontally, you have a perfect representation of the Danish flag or a symbol or whatever it is. They are unbelievable. And just, I can't even imagine what it would be like to use those. I mean, Ivan Day, who Sam mentioned, has those moulds and has used them and can turn them out. And he's probably the only person on earth who can. Although you're going to tell me that you're about to remake one. And
oh, no, they're very expensive. They're real, real fancy. So we 3D scanned them and then remade them. And yeah. Well, and so but they are really, really hard to use, and they're just hypnotic. They're mesmerizing. You have it on the table, and the first time you see one, you can't imagine how it was made.
What is it that you're seeing that you can't imagine?
So normally, if you're setting jellies, you can set the layers horizontally. And here you have a core shot through the jelly going right the way vertically up it, and in a contrasting colour that is glistening in the light. It's utterly decorative, especially if you imagine tablescapes illuminated by candlelight, and this quivering as people gently nudge it. Yeah. as well. It's, you know, still amazing.
They are mind-boggling. You also get, at this point, still this kind of the savoury jellies, which is something we haven't really talked about. Mm. Those are also still very much in vogue. So there's a man called Theodore Garrett who wrote the Encyclopedia of Practical Cookery, which is about as practical as a chocolate teapot. It's, I mean, some of the recipes are really practical, but it comes in 8 volumes and it is mind-boggling. And his jelly section, which is an interesting thing, contains recipes for what we would now call jam, so jelly as in currant jelly, those kind of things, fine. Restorative jellies, so invalid jellies, which was another branch of jelly making, but they were usually not set and turned out. They were just sort of given to invalids at that point in a cup. And also lots and lots of savoury jellies. So he has one which is an Italian jelly, which has got cheese set in it. But it's with a sweet calf's foot jelly. And I'm kind of looking at that. I was looking at it the other day thinking, this is something I'm suddenly feeling the urge to make, to set sort of fontina or something like that in a sweet calf's foot jelly. Just strikes me as something that would hurt every sense that you have in a modern way. And therefore almost it's worth trying. I mean, I love cheese and I love jelly, but I'm not sure how it works.
No, it'd be amazing.
I'd be up for it.
I think don't hold back.
Sam, have you done savoury jellies?
Yeah, a little bit, but more as an accompaniment to the main course rather than the course itself.
So what kind of thing would it be?
To go with some sort of lamb dish or something like that, setting, you know, making a rosemary jelly that sits alongside it can be quite nice.
There was always, when you had your Sunday roast, there was often anyway a bit of jelly at the bottom, that combination of gravy and jelly, which
exactly.
Was magnificent.
Oh, yeah. Especially when you dip your roast potatoes in it and squidge them down, and then, yeah, that one.
Yes! Say it again.
but jelly's so back in fashion. You've got Gucci putting out campaigns at the moment with jelly front and centre. And, you know, part of it is the delight, part of it is the sort of nostalgia, but some of it is like the horror of jelly as well. So, you know, those jellies that can really sort of alarm and excite at the same time, like some of those, are finding their way back into a repertoire.
Yeah, I mean, there are some pretty horrific jellies. The Americans did their savoury salad jellies and their candle jellies and their jellies in a can where you, there are some excesses that I think I'm glad we had an ocean between us.
What was the savoury salads.
Salads, yeah.
How does that go?
So there was a thing in America for a Jell-O salad, Jell-O being the leading brand of packet ready-made jelly over there, so the equivalent of sort of Rowntree's or Hartley's, the cubes. And there was a vogue for setting all the elements of a salad, sometimes cooked elements, into sweet jellies. So the classic example is something like a lime Jell-O jelly, very, very sweet, very, very synthetic. And into that you would set grapes, lettuce, walnuts, olives. You might mix it with a bit of mayonnaise as well, maybe some cooked potato, and you sort of build this thing up, and every single element adds absolute horror to the entire thing, and then it would be served in slices. So by that point, all the textures would kind of have disappeared of everything inside it, and you'd have this sort of sweet, sour, saccharine, sharp mashup. I mean, it's almost worse than trifle, and I think that's saying something.
But it does look spectacular.
It looks amazing.
It looks incredible. It looks like it, you know, bedazzled with jewels. And if you're putting together a sideboard, maybe there's a space for it. Right at the back.
But why not do it with fruits?
I can't stand salad. Maybe that's where it's going wrong. I just need to start setting it again.
Rowntree's and Hartley's. When did they arrive on the scene?
Well, you could get pre-made jelly in bottles, really, by the 1870s. So you could go out and you could buy your jelly ready to sort of reheat on the stove. You could even get a ready-moulded jelly in a tin, which you just sort of popped the top off and then turned it out. But the real heyday for pre-made jellies is between the wars. So 1920s was when Rowntree's turned what had been a slab jelly, so you would buy it as a slab, into those cubes you add water to. So the 1920s and 30s really was a time when jelly had finally come down, really, from just being on the tables of the aristocracy to being democratised and very much available to all. And at that point, you stop seeing so many amazing jellies on the tables of the rich, partly because they simply don't have the staff between the wars to make these incredible things. And even if they did have the staff, those staff, there were fewer of them, the ingredients were not necessarily available. It's ironic, really, because you actually start to get commercially produced ice, which means that people could actually make these things more easily, but then that's part of the reason, of course, they fall out of fashion, because once they're available to everyone, the rich don't want them. So that interwar period was really crucial for jelly development in terms of industrial jellies, those cubes, but also in terms of things like mass-produced molds that were really, really cheap. You don't get plastic till after the Second World War, but you could get enamelware molds, which work quite well. So that is when we get jelly, as I suppose we grew up with, most of us, in terms of things like the rabbit with the bow tie on.
Yeah.
And the packet jelly that you just added some tinned fruit to if you were feeling really sophisticated. That's that key period, 1920s and 30s. Of course, it disappears pretty much during the war because you can't get hold of the sugar, and then comes roaring back in the 1950s, partly because people go, gosh, I remember before the war when we had jellies and ice creams and it was amazing. I really missed them, and now I want jelly all the time. So the 1950s sees a massive upsurge in jelly and loads of different kiddie moulds, so tortoises and teddy bears and that kind of thing.
Going back to the Hartleys and Roundtree's slab jelly and jelly cubes, it's a really good product.
Oh, it is.
It is quite incredible as a product. And I think because it's so familiar to us in Britain, we don't celebrate it. And having looked at products around the world, if you buy jelly, it's still sort of powdered gelatin. It's kind of gross. when you make it because you're using that powdered gelatin, you really smell it being quite animalistic, whereas it's quite different when you're using
I've used powdered gelatin a few times and really not got on with it. I mean, I think as well they are such iconic products. I mean, Roundtree's obviously doesn't exist anymore, and yet it does as a brand name just for that product. So, I mean, I've always found the flavours not strong enough, and I also find that they don't always retain their shape unless you're using a very flat mould. But, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that they are sunk deep into the psyche of anyone born before about 1990.
Absolutely. You talked earlier about the magic of jellies. What is more magical than breaking off one of those cubes, putting the hot water in, stir, 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 stir. The little cube gets smaller and smaller until it's nothing. Then it cools down. It goes into a mould. It comes out again. You've got a jelly. You made it yourself. You could be about 3.5 and you could make a jelly. It's just great.
It is just joyful.
One final question. Do you have a cunning plan? What I'm really after is what you might see for the future of jelly. Sam, you're the guy who invests in jelly.
Well, I mean, we've not talked about Benham and Froude, but we have talked about the Alexandra Cross. And the Alexandra Cross, that very complex mould, is one of the Benham and Froude moulds. Benham and Froude was the maker of the Rolls-Royce of the jelly mould here. And it sadly became defunct as a company about 100 years ago. But if you find a copper mould that's got a little Auburn Cross logo on it, that's a Benham and Froude jelly. And the Auburn Cross comes because they used to gild the finials on top of St. Paul's Cathedral. So that's the St. Paul's Auburn Cross that you're seeing on that jelly mould. And we've been working to bring back Benham and Froude to make it, to put it, to give everyone. I mean, we found it very, very hard to find decent jelly moulds, just to make them available so that people can use great jelly moulds. So yeah, Benham and Froude jelly moulds. We're reinstating the company, and hopefully we can reinstate jelly as well.
Yeah. I'd love to think that savoury jellies are going to make a comeback as well, especially with sustainable eating being so much in vogue now, quite rightly. The very fact that actually jellies are a really good way to eat in a nose-to-tail way, the fact that jelly is delightful, and the fact that it's quite low cost and low key. I'd like to see sweet and savoury jellies come back with a wow. And if they're all using Benham and Froude moulds, so much the better, especially the one that I've got from you, which I think is supposed to be the Dome of Brighton Pavilion, but it looks a lot like a breast. Excellent. I mean, you know, who wouldn't love that on their table?
Thank you both very much. Thanks for listening. If you want to join in the conversation, you can find me on X at Tony Robinson, and you can follow all our podcast news on X and Instagram at CunningCastPod. And please don't forget to follow this podcast so you don't miss a single episode. They're all pure gold. Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast is produced by Melissa Fitzgerald, and it's a Zinc Media production.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.